The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
In March 1947, Earl Louis Mountbatten and his wife Edwina arrive in New Delhi. The great-grandson of Queen Victoria and second cousin to George VI, Mountbatten brings a regal presence to the drama of India's independence. As the last viceroy, he bears responsibility for India's fate. Fearing a total loss of control, Mountbatten brings forward the transfer of power to August. Two nations will be created by partition, a secular India and a new homeland for India's Muslims, Pakistan.
Long years ago, we made a tryst with destiny, and now the time comes when we shall redeem our pledge. At the stroke of the midnight hour, when the world sleeps, India will awake to life and freedom.
The biggest democracy in the world is going to the elections this month, and it will take a month for 800 million eligible Indians to vote. We won't know the result until May. Not only has India become an immensely important country politically and economically over the past 30 years, it has also grown hugely in worldwide cultural significance. That is partly thanks to all the great new authors writing in English. They themselves are spread out across the globe, as are their subjects. So this seemed like an excellent opportunity to find out how this literary landscape looked from inside India. Here's one of our Delhi correspondents, Anu Anand.
It may not be the most glamorous way to buy your next bedtime read, but here in the centre of New Delhi, many book lovers peruse the latest titles not in the comfort of an air-conditioned bookstore, but out on the pavement, amid the crush of pedestrians, the honking traffic, and even a couple of sleeping stray dogs. Now, the titles are laid right out on the floor, but don't be fooled. This is a sophisticated international collection. There's Dan Brown, P.G. Woodhouse. I'm looking at a biography of Aung San Suu Kyi, Jeffrey Archer, Amitav Ghosh. And there's a gentleman here looking at the book. So what are you looking for? What have you got there in your hand?
I've got The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I heard that there was a movie released by the same name, so I thought maybe reading from the book will give me a better grip on the story.
But you also had a very serious book that you handed to the vendor here. What was that?
Yeah, it was The Argumentative Indian by Dr. Amartya Sen. I'm planning to join politics, actually. And I do wish to get a deep insight on the economics and sociology of the Indian society.
Do you think most people have such wide reading interests like you? You know, this kind of thriller and then a really philosophical, thoughtful book on India?
Yeah, there's a little bit of Bollywood in all of us.
Now, India is the third biggest producer of books in English, but also the market for books here is growing annually by an estimated 8 to 10%. Major international publishers like Bloomsbury, Hachette, and Simon & Schuster have beaten a path to India's door. For them and for indigenous publishers, India remains a literary powerhouse. Caroline Newbury is vice president of marketing at Penguin Random House India.
there are a number of hugely respected Indian writers, not only here within the subcontinent itself, but also internationally. I mean, even just this year, Jhumpa Lahiri's The Lowland was obviously, well, shortlisted for the Booker, National Book Awards in the US. I think it's just been longlisted for the Baileys in the UK. Whenever there is a new Salman Rushdie and Amitabh Ghosh, any of those, they attract a huge amount of interest and kind of coverage, not only within India, but internationally too. I think probably what there also is, which isn't as well reflected internationally, is a whole range of much more a kind of younger generation, a kind of new or sort of different India. So I'm kind of thinking of authors like Chetan Bhagat, those kind of people who are writing sort of campus IT novels. And then also there's a huge popularity for books which have their basis within Indian mythology, Indian history. So, you know, I mean, the biggest books at the moment and, you know, the biggest selling book last year was one from Amish Tripathi. His trilogy around Shiva has been absolutely huge. We have Ashwin Sanghi, who is sort of writing Dan Brown-esque thrillers, but very much, again, set within that mythological world.
Now, if you've never read an Indian campus IT novel, here's a flavor. I typed in the Google search bar, condom burst, what next? I Googled everything, emergency, contraceptives, India. Darn! In India, these were still prescription drugs, whereas in the US, they were sold over the counter. No wonder India is bursting with people. One condom snaps and you have a kid in your hands, and your parents disown you and you have to marry the guy. I waited as she took quite some time in the washroom. I pinned my ears to the door and could hear her cry inside. I didn't know what to say. Thomas Abraham is managing director of Hachette India.
There's a simple formula to them. Essentially, it is, if you're familiar with the 70s, 80s movies or series called Porky's in American cinema, or the American Pie kind of movies that are later, they're essentially campus romps. There's just enough sex thrown in. There's a lot of so-called romance. And the key formula is that they are written in the lingo that I think 60 to 70% of the small town college going kids speak in. And that means very clearly withholding the more cerebral editor's pen from that kind of language to keep it.
Would it be fair to describe that as a sort of Indian English, a patois, if you like?
Absolutely. I think that would be absolutely accurate. In the beginning, I think the instinctive reaction is that, for instance, critics looking at them would be very, very snooty. Now, the English within quotes, the conventional sense, is completely atrocious. But I don't think these books are trying to be that. They are just, I don't think they even see themselves as being representatives of any language. It's just a kind of communication on text that is connected to an audience that wanted it, and that has exploded. So the bestsellers there, for instance, go over 100,000 copies, which are phenomenal. The caveat being they have to be priced very, very cheap.
So we're talking again about $2 or less.
$1 and a bit. And the other key element to those books were actually their titles. So if you see, they all have a certain pattern to them, which was that she left me, I didn't. So there is a formula element to the title. It'll be a phrasing of 5 to 6 words. And I was told by the publisher of one of those companies that it has to be under about 30 characters. So they actually have mapped it down, much like the Mills and Boon phenomenon in the West, which is clearly formula publishing driven to a fixed kind of market, and that's exactly what has opened up the market here.
Of course, India isn't just an English-speaking nation. It's also a Punjabi, Tamil, Gujarati, Kashmiri, Malayali, and Telugu-speaking nation, to name just a few of the official languages.
And here at New Delhi Railway Station, you can really soak in the diversity of this vast country. I'm standing on a passenger bridge overlooking several platforms, and I can see women in South Indian yellow and pink and red silk saris balancing luggage on their heads. There are men in turbans from Western India and pilgrims, Hindu pilgrims coming from various sites across the country. Just over half of all books published here are in regional languages, and many people still buy those books on railway platforms. I'm standing next to one of the book stalls here at the station, and they've got Bengali magazines, they've got comic books for children in various languages, and of course the fantastically lurid covers of Hindi pulp fiction. There's one here called The Soil of My Nation, and it shows the Indian flag with a woman dressed in military gear, complete with black nail polish and holding a gun. And these, of course, are hugely popular. Rajesh Joshi grew up buying books from railway stalls like this one. He's now a senior editor with the BBC's Hindi service in New Delhi.
You know, when Arundhati Roy writes a book, people all over the world start talking about it. And they think that every person in India understands and speaks and reads English, which is not the case. India is a huge country, 1.2 billion people, and thousands of languages are spoken and written. More than 16 officially recognized languages are there, with different scripts, different literature, different cultural background. And people are creating literature in their own languages. So there's no dearth of literary energy coming out from small towns. But unfortunately, people don't know about it. Like, I want to give this example of a very young writer from Lucknow. His name is Anil Yadav. Now, nobody knows of Anil Yadav, but he writes beautiful prose in Hindi. He's written travelogues. He has written political commentary and beautiful language. I mean, I can give it in writing that I haven't come across that kind of fluency and that kind of vision in any other language, but nobody knows about Anil Yadav.
And yet, young Indians especially also want to read in English, according to the independent publishing consultant Jaya Bhattacharjee Rose.
Well, 40% of the population is below the age of 25. So that is a young population. English is the language of communication, of social mobility.
You were making the point to me, part of the reason that the homegrown authors really work is because they mix languages. They borrow from English and they borrow from Hindi and other languages. And it's a mishmash, it's a patois, it's Hinglish, if you like. I can think of a few phrases and words like time pass, meaning hanging around, just doing something because you've got nowhere else to go. Or one that I really love is funda, which I actually thought was a Hindi word, but it turns out it's from fundamental. When you say, what's the funda, it's like, okay, what's this all about? What's the deal?
I only recognize them when I'm reading them in print. Because as an editor, one would say that, you know, you're looking for the Queen's English, but you're not always getting it. When A Suitable Boy first came out, there was huge debate about should there be the Indian words which he used, should they not be italicized, should they not be a glossary? And it consumed literary criticism for years. 20 years on, we've got to a stage where nobody italicizes the words, nobody offers you a glossary, nobody offers you an explanation. You, like any other reader worldwide, is expected to fathom the meaning of the word from the context of the story on the page.
And just while we're talking, I'm thinking about White Tiger, Aravind Adiga, with a character who speaks in such colorful terms, but also Sea of Poppies, which is a historical novel set in India during the opium trade, but has an amazing patois, not just of Indian English, but Malaysian English and Chinese English. And that was kind of one of the great pleasures of reading it.
Exactly. You see the unapologetic way and the confidence with which writers are writing today. And, you know, I'm not even talking about India over here. Even the South Asian writers, everyone is writing with this wonderful confidence, great sophistication. That is, I think, a great way in which you can say literature is coming into its own.
There are lots of ways in which Indian literature is maturing. Now, I'm just a stone's throw from some of the trendiest restaurants and boutiques in New Delhi. But in this back lane live the laborers, the tailors, the domestic workers, the people who are building Delhi from the ground up. And I've come to find that everyday India through some of its critically acclaimed nonfiction.
Hello, I'm Aman Sethi and I'm the author of A Free Man. Mohammad Ashraf is a Safedi Wala. Sometimes he is a mazdoor at a construction site hauling sacks of cement up endless flights of stairs. Sometimes he is a beldar mixing the cement that mazdoors bring to him. But he sees himself primarily as a Safedi Karigar, a master house painter. Ashraf tells me one of his favorite stories, that of his first night in Delhi when, for him, the city was still a mysterious place of freedom, camaraderie and possibility. I arrived on the late night train from Surat, Gujarat at around 9:30 at Old Delhi railway station. I had nothing on me, absolutely nothing. One bundle of clothes and maybe two or three bidis. On the train, someone had said that in Delhi the police harassed those who slept on railway platforms, so I thought I would sleep outside Jama Masjid. But the guard told me that the masjid was closed for the night. I slipped into one of the lanes near the masjid and I saw some people playing cards. You should always ask permission before approaching a group of card players, because if any money goes missing later, they will always blame it on you. So I said, "Bhaiya, I'm new to this place. Can I sleep somewhere around here?" They looked up and one of them said, "Have you eaten?" I shook my head. He pressed a 5-rupee coin into my hand and pointed me towards a stall. I ate, bought some bidis, unrolled my sheet and fell asleep right there on the pavement.
So, I mean, while other people are writing about sort of Mughal splendors or the Raj, you spent quite a few years drinking some cheap liquor, smoking a few acrid biris with daily wage laborers. Why did you want to write about that?
I work as a journalist and I chanced upon Ashraf and his colleagues in the course of a story. And I found that they had a very interesting take on the city, and I felt that there was a way in which Delhi was being repackaged as this ancient civilization now on the verge of becoming a superpower. And I felt it would be interesting to write a different approach to the city, which looked at the city from below rather than from the top down.
You write about people who are living on the thinnest of margins with the smallest of safety nets.
I suppose there's just a sort of precarity to everyday life, which is hard to understand unless you actually spend time there. And I think the most interesting thing for me was the lack of just kind of normal life logistics. You know, if you live on the street, where do you save your money? Do you have a bank? How do you get a phone? Where do you go to the bathroom? How do you make sure your possessions aren't stolen at night? How do you safeguard your tools? So I think these sort of banal difficulties are actually the ones that kind of gradually accumulate and make life very difficult on the street, rather than the big picture stories of, you know, lack of health insurance, for example.
What things surprised you about the way that they coped with these everyday problems?
There are tremendous social networks that are built between populations that are extremely transient. So you could be someone who's living in a particular space for only a couple of months, but upon your arrival, you get enmeshed into an existing system of where you go for various things, a little mapped form of solidarity between people within a community. I think part of the problem is this attempt to encapsulate 1.2 billion people into one narrative that doesn't make any sense. And the big arc narrative, I think, is dead. This kind of essentialization of large communities has been exposed as a kind of boring narrative that served its purpose. And so I think there's a tremendous amount of interest in stories, in everyday stories of everyday people.
Journalist Aman Sethi, ending that report from Anu Anand.
The sleeping elephant has awoken. The former world power is swiftly heading towards its previous position as a factor to be reckoned with. India has been reborn. Over the last two decades, the Indian economy has grown 4 times its size since 1991. But how has this been possible? What factors have...
Delhi itself, like the whole country, has changed enormously over the last 30 years, physically as much as socially and economically. In 1991, the present Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh, was appointed Finance Minister. The country was in a financial pickle and he was given the task of opening up the Indian economy to the outside world. 30 years on, a significant proportion of the world's billionaires are Indian, and the capital city has been transformed by a modern middle class. They've knocked down many of the old buildings to construct thousands of apartment blocks.
Driving past Delhi's sole dealer of Bentleys and Lamborghinis, I stop in on a whim and ask to speak to the manager. He's not around, and I'm sent to have coffee with the PR girls. They're appropriately attractive, and judging by their diamonds, from the right kind of family. "I've driven a million Porsches and Lamborghinis," says one. "They're nice cars, but when you get into a Lamborghini, it's something else." For them, Delhi is a place of infinite money-making, and they fall over themselves trying to express this fantastic fecundity. When someone comes in here looking to buy a Bentley, we don't ask him what he's driving now. Just because he drives a BMW doesn't mean he can afford a Bentley. We ask if he has a jet or a yacht. We ask if he has an island. "Are there many people with jets in Delhi?" I ask. The girls wax apoplectic. "Everyone has one. And not just one, they have two, three, four." We chat about nice cars and expensive living. A Lamborghini is driven into the showroom. The noise is so deafening that we have to stop talking until it's in place. I ask the Philistines question, "What's the point of spending 30 million rupees or $600,000 on a car that can do over 300 kilometers per hour in a city where the traffic doesn't move?" They tell me about the car club that meets at night in the diplomatic enclave, where the roads are straight, wide and empty. You have to have at least like a BMW or a Mercedes to join. They meet at midnight and they race their cars. The Prime Minister's office is always calling us to complain. Why? Because the Prime Minister can't sleep. These engines make so much noise they keep him awake. So he calls us to complain, but obviously there's nothing we can do. As I drive away, I cannot help thinking of Prime Minister Manmohan Singh tossing and turning in bed, his snowy hair unturbaned on the pillow, his dreams interrupted by the rich boys' Ferraris screaming up and down the roads outside. Manmohan Singh is, of course, the man who long ago, as finance minister, opened the window to the storm of global capitalism and set the course for a new oligarchic elite.
That was the novelist Rana Dasgupta reading from his new book, Capital, which tells the story of the new New Delhi. Rana grew up in the UK, but went back to India at the turn of the century. He sees a city now dominated by money-making. As Aman Sethi found, the rich need a poor working class to serve them, but have left most of that class as slum dogs. Rana explained the situation to our former Delhi correspondent, Randeep Ramesh.
At the time that I decided that I wanted to chronicle things that were going on around me, very conspicuous changes had happened. There were suddenly fast cars on the road and a lot of boutiques selling expensive stuff, and there was a boom in property prices. But there was also a change in the ways that people looked at the world, the ways that they related to money and work and products, and the ways that they related to family and relationships. And I felt that this was an important place and time in the history of capitalism that needed to be documented and really explored in depth. And what I found was that whether they were rich or poor or whatever profession they had or station they had in life, it was a decade of immense intensity. They were all trying to keep up with what was going on around them. They were all trying to shift their inner universe to remain relevant and functional in a world that was changing very fast.
Your opening line, "March is the cruelest month," is resonant of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. Was that on purpose? I mean, he also looks at the alienation of capitalist processes.
That idea of the wasteland, that idea of the rubble, is something that we are confronted with living in Delhi. The figurative rubble, really, of stuff that's just been destroyed and from which we have to kind of emerge and rebuild. But also, I wanted to situate this book in a tradition, a modernist tradition of writing about capitalism and capitalist society, of writing about all its grand productivity and achievement, but also its spiritual malaise and anxiety and all the inequality and violence that it produces. Eliot is part of that, but also
people like Kafka and Marx and Brecht, who's also given an epigraph in the book, going back to Baudelaire and Goethe, because the story that I'm telling here is not just an Indian story, it's a much older story. It's a story of centuries of capitalist expansion. What we now have to contend with is that places that are rising to positions of influence within the global system, their experience of capitalism is very new. Europe and America sort of between them invented this system and managed it for two or three centuries, and it was their system, and they were philosophically attuned to it. Whereas places like Russia and China and India spent much of the 20th century not only shut off from it, but being told that it was the source of all evil. And so when suddenly it floods in, it causes very, very ambivalent feelings. Are we now what we always hated? Are we now the enemy? Or are we now corrupted? Even people who are joyfully money-making, exuberantly materialist in their lives, are also very fearful of what it is doing to them.
You don't necessarily locate the big changes in Delhi in 1991. Actually, you go back a bit beyond to look at 47 and partition.
Before that period, precisely because there had been such strict government controls over business, and business had been very devalued as a social activity, the idea of private accumulation of wealth was frowned upon in the idea of India propagated by its first Prime Minister Nehru. And business people were obliged to turn to government for licenses, even for the smallest of business changes or expansions, introductions of new products, expansions of factories. It meant that bureaucrats and politicians were able to control business very greatly. So over the previous two or three decades before 1991, you'd seen this drift of business people to Delhi, because being far from the capital meant they were excluded from this process. They had to be socializing with these bureaucrats. They had to be paying them money and basically creating networks in the capital in order for their businesses to be viable. That made it very different from the rest of the country. It was a hustling, corrupt set of backroom relationships. And just as in the Soviet Union, where a similar entrepreneurial class had formed around politics, these people were well poised in 1991 to seize assets that were deregulated by state monopolies, which could be mines or land or telecoms. And so suddenly these people's wealth leapt up into a different kind of scale, and several billion-dollar fortunes were accumulated in the years after 1991. None of this happens in a cultural vacuum. Most importantly of all, perhaps, as you say, the partition of India of 1947, when a stream of refugees settled in Delhi from one of the 20th century's major catastrophes, in which they left behind property, business, and money, and came often penniless to settle in the capital, having also seen rape and murder on a very large scale. So their relationship to things like money was extremely anxious. They'd lost everything. And rebuilding and accumulating seemed like a very high kind of calling. They just wanted to put their heads down and make sure their sons and daughters were never going to face that kind of thing again. And they wanted to build walls around their houses and make sure they were financially insulated from any of those kind of catastrophes again. So a lot of the culture of money-making in Delhi has a very warrior-like spirit, which comes from this turbulent history, and which means that, in fact, the making of money rather than the building of a society is sort of deeply ingrained as a culture.
Now, you're best known as a novelist. Why did you choose nonfiction as the vehicle to describe Delhi?
Well, I really felt that I'd lived through something very dramatic that I really wanted to report on factually, because I wanted readers to know that it was true, that it was fact, and that it was part of their world. I wanted to write a book in which I went out and I spoke to people, and in which I discovered how they lived, and I was sure that it was more strange than I could make up, and it was indeed. And many of these characters have lived very strange things, and they've had to really battle to keep up with those things. The other thing is that I wanted to describe the physical changes of the city that had happened over that period, what it felt like to see a city ripped down and rebuilt. The Delhi I moved to in 2000 was still, in many ways, quite quaint compared to what you can see right now. It was still, in many ways, continuous with the British administrative city built in the 1920s and 30s. It was still a city that went to bed earlier. Apart from the few five-star hotels which had their glittering bars and restaurants, the general landscape of the city shut down about 9 p.m. and there were very few clubs and bars and restaurants that one could go out to. All that has changed since, and it has changed because there's been a huge sort of transfer of the city's physical resources to the middle classes and elites. Slums were knocked down, hundreds of thousands of people were moved physically out of the city. The Commonwealth Games of 2010 was the pretext for a big reordering of space, and the transfer of these kinds of lands to real estate developers who use them to build shopping malls and residential apartment complexes. The physical look of the city changed, and with it all the feelings of the city changed.
Randy Ramesh talking to Rana Dasgupta. Capital is published by Canongate. Finally, we move to India's other major city, Mumbai, or as some still prefer to call it, Bombay, and an author who is one of the country's globetrotters. Manil Suri is a mathematician based in the US who's brought up in Mumbai. Judging by the fantastical nature of his third novel, The City of Devi, which has just come out in paperback, writing is the fun side of his life. Set in the near future, it reveals a city in turmoil with religious civil war between Hindus and Muslims. Meanwhile, people are fleeing because of an expected nuclear attack by Pakistan. Suri explained his plotting to Lindsay Irving.
Well, I think the purpose of fiction is to look at sort of the ends of the curve in terms of probability. And so I think this is really at the edges of that, what might actually happen. It's great for making fiction and making a scenario where these characters are completely desperate.
The main focus of the novel is on an impossible love triangle.
What I had always in mind was this idea that two people would be searching for the ones that they loved just when everything might actually end in a few days, in 4 days actually. So Sarita is the wife whose husband has mysteriously disappeared, and she has to find him. She's always been a little awkward. She's invested all her chances for happiness in him, and so she's very determined to actually find him and actually also find the answer to why her marriage has not quite worked in the way that she would expect it.
Her husband has not yet. He's taking a very long time to consummate.
He's done certain things. So he's comfortable with certain sexual acts, but not the main one. And then there's Karun, who is the husband. He's a physicist. He's also someone who's very a little withdrawn, a little shy, a little hesitant. And you don't really get to know him till the very end. He's sort of unattainable in some ways, and that's what causes him to be attractive.
And he's kind of awkwardly getting to know himself.
Exactly. He probably hasn't really realized where he stands in the spectrum. And then there's Jazz, who is the gay character. He's Muslim. He's really open about his sexuality. He's discovered himself through sex, essentially. And he's
physically very gifted in that way. He's a good-looking young man.
He's good-looking, and he's always on the prowl for action. The city is a wide playground for him. And he is someone who actually has lived through sex and then finds love and loses it and doesn't even realize it. And then when this scenario occurs, he figures that he should also look for the person that he's lost.
He is very comfortably young, gay man. Did it feel like a sort of daring thing to depict in a novel?
It did. I really had to kind of figure out where I was going to set the dial when I was trying to figure out how honest to make him, how out to make him, how sexually adventurous to make him. And I just decided I had to go all the way. So he's this really extroverted character, and he has a lot of sex in the novel. And one of the questions that I had was, well, how would the Indian public take it? And that's been, you know, I went to India for a book tour and I was told, don't read out any of the jazz scenes. They said it's a very conservative city. Don't read out anything by jazz. And so naturally, that's exactly what I did. And you know, the city survived. Nobody fainted. Three people walked out, which, of course, was delightful. But that's about it.
Of the three characters, Jazz is nominally Muslim and the other two are more or less nominally Hindu. For them, religion is more or less a social obstacle rather than a central part of their lives, isn't it?
Yeah, so religion doesn't come across too well in this book, I think. Part of the thing that has also happened is there's this movement going on in the country to split the Hindus and the Muslims. And so these characters, Jazz and Sarita, they play off each other very well because one is Muslim, one is Hindu, and they can negotiate the different gangs which have divided the city into different camps.
Those kind of sectarian differences have been very present in Bombay over the years, haven't they, with Shiv Sena and so on?
Yeah, they keep popping up and then they die down, and it's something that, you know, you cannot expect will ever go away. You have to remember that India's history was where the country was partitioned into India and Pakistan. I mean, several hundred thousand people died in that, so we've never seen that level of violence again. If there were violence in the city, it would be manifested first in poorer areas. So someone who's middle class would be sort of insulated from it. And I think what's shocked the city in the past is when that barrier is broken. And suddenly in this scenario, all the barriers are down. So this is why it's so shocking to all the characters. Like in the first scene, there are these people who are dressed almost like they're going to a wedding, and they're suddenly finding themselves in this bomb shelter, and they're hanging on to their snobbishness and, you know, discriminating against each other based on what they're wearing. So that's kind of what I imagine the end to look like in Bombay.
The novel's outlook, as you're saying, is pretty secular, but it's structured around Hindu deities.
Usually it's Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma. Brahma is the creator, but for this book, it was really a question of getting this deity to come down to earth in a human form and perhaps save the city or perhaps destroy it. And Brahma wasn't quite up to the task. He's just the creator. So the mother goddess, who is the patron goddess of Mumbai, seemed to make the most sense. And at some point I realized that, you know, there's this ongoing metaphor in the book where Vishnu, Shiva, and Devi, they're these three deities, and there's also three characters, Karun and Jazz and Sarita. And so they're almost metaphorically linked to each other. The mythological connection isn't that strong in this book. It's more just the idea that this mother goddess can take several different incarnations. And I really get to it via Bollywood more than anything else, where there is a movie called Super Devi. And this is a kind of part Slumdog Millionaire, part Superman. It's about this girl.
Big blockbuster, yeah, sci-fi.
Yeah, it's this huge blockbuster. This little girl from the Bombay slums has extra arms, and she can actually take on any avatar of Devi to fight crime. So she becomes a call center worker and this and that. And it's kind of, you know, over the top. But it's also something that has been used in the villages to foment this kind of religious intolerance. What that movie allows me to do is, you know, have these scenes where at one point Jazz and Sarita burst upon the set where this movie was actually shot, and they actually have an aerial fight with lasers in midair. So that was great fun to write. And so you know, I'm told that every good Indian novel has to have an elephant. So there's an elephant in this book because I didn't in my first two. So, you know, all my public has been waiting for that. So now I've satisfied that.
As well as a novelist, you're also a mathematician, which seems a very unlikely combination. But I understand, as perhaps you were hinting at in the way you were talking about arranging the building blocks of the plot, has actually come in useful for your novel writing.
It did and it didn't, because at some point I decided I was really having a hard time tying together all the strands. So I started making these elaborate plot lines, sort of like you might have seen for a chess game where white moves, and then for each move possible, you plot out all the moves that black can have. And you get this branching structure, and then you can go through these branches and pick out the best one. So I did that with a plot. Jazz does this, and then Sarita can do this. And I kept finding that nothing worked. There were dead ends everywhere. Everything was too unbelievable or cliched. You know, after that, I thought, okay, I've actually come up with a mathematical proof that this novel this novel cannot be written. And that was greatly liberating. It absolved me of my duties both as a novelist and as a mathematician. And I was able to put this aside and go on to another novel. And it was only later when I saw this metaphor of the Trinity and the three characters that I was able to figure out what to do.
Manil Suri talking to Lindsay Irvin. The City of Devi is published by Bloomsbury. It's been fascinating to discover so much new about India. From Monday, the country, its politics and culture will be the subject of a week-long Guardian-wide focus. Meanwhile, if you're one of our international readers, find out about the rice conservationists sowing seeds of hope for Indian farmers in Guardian Weekly. Next week, we on the Books Podcast will be at the London Book Fair examining European writers. In the meantime, do subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or SoundCloud and tell your friends all about us too. I'm Claire Armistead and my producer is Tim Mabey. From both of us, goodbye. Bharat Bhagya Vidhata Punjab Singh Gujarat Maratha Dravid Utkal Banga Vindhya Himachal
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.